Everybody ready for a great day? It's going to be great.
Lisa.
Is that good?
Okay. Lisa.
Yeah, I'm ready.
2, 1. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Do you wish you could create music for a living? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you about the careers in music that you probably haven't even heard of.
If you listen to The Lisa Show and you think, you know, in real life, Lisa Valentine Clark and I would be best friends, I have a movie recommendation for you coming up as part of your morning buzz. That's coming up in about 15 minutes.
Has a magazine cover ever piqued your interest because it told you you could lose over 20 pounds in your first month with this new secret diet? Or how many ads do you see that pop up on Instagram or Facebook that are like, this one secret changed everything?
Just click here.
Yeah, oh. Yeah, no, I fell for it. Well, you're not alone. According to a recent study, Americans spend over $33 billion, with a B, dollars on weight loss products every year. And a lot of that money goes to that quick detox diets and quick fix plans. Do they actually work? Now, I know that this is a sensitive subject for a lot of people, right? Something that, you know, some people may not share, you know, with others, and some may, but they're enticing. And have you ever had that conversation with one of your friends or close, you know, family members of like, well, did you try it?
Yeah, well, what do you think?
What do you think? Uh-huh. You know, will it work?
So the thought that I always have, and that it always comes back to me, like the idea of the get rich overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
Lose 10 pounds in 1 week. Like I sort of lump all of those things together.
Oh, interesting.
And I just kind of go, well, maybe, but probably that is either too risky or not actually going to provide the long-term results, you know, that you would want, right? Especially when we're talking about diet stuff.
Well, and the old adage, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, kind of creeps in, right?
Uh-huh.
And you have to sort of weigh that, pun included, the pros and cons with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that these are so prevalent and that they're everywhere, we wanted to sort of get to the bottom of not only why these are attractive to us, but what we can do to really, really know not only if they work, but why they, what actually does work. So today we're speaking with registered dietitian Isla Garcia about whether or not these quick fixes and detox diets are going to get you the results you want. Welcome, Isla.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you today?
Awesome. I'm doing so well.
So we've been talking about detox diets and the prevalence that they have of popping up and trying to get us to try them. What are your thoughts on detox diets? Do they actually work?
So in my opinion, or what I find too in research, is that detox diets, they don't do really anything magical for you, but I do feel like it does help you to feel more hydrated, feel more energized because of all the vitamins, minerals you can get from it. But from like a weight loss standpoint, it's not going to do a whole lot. So typically what I recommend is if you're trying to do a detox, you can totally go for it if you feel like it makes you feel better, just knowing that a lot of times you're spending all that money for not a whole lot of reward from it. And instead, it might be a better idea to just drink a bunch of water and eat a bunch of fruits and vegetables, but because there's not anything in and of itself that is super magical about it.
So how exactly then do you define a detox diet?
So detox diet, I don't really push for any sort of detox diet. I guess how the media would define it is maybe somehow you're thinking that you're like pulling out all the toxins in your body, but it doesn't really work like that because your body is always doing that. That's why we have kidneys. That's why we have livers. And when people go into liver and kidney damage, it doesn't, your body is becoming more toxic. So you can't really do a full on detox diet unless you're like in kidney failure and then they pull out all these toxins from your blood.
So we hear about that a lot, though, like this will pull out toxins for your body. And then, you know, there's all these different products that you can buy and things like that. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying, well, that's not really how it works. Our body does that naturally. Is there because these claims are out there, is there something that can help you feel healthier that actually works?
Yes. So again, like I said, if you buy those juices and they make you feel better, I would never say don't buy them if they make you feel better. But if you are really trying to like just overall make your body feel better without having to fall into the prey of all the media telling you to detox, just like I said, drink more water and eat more fruits and vegetables, because when you add more fiber, you know, that's going to have you have a great bowel movement and actually pull everything out, like any blockage in your stomach or anything. And then the hydration is also going to make you feel better. So that's always what I recommend if somebody's really wanting to feel detox. I feel like what they really want to do is just feel better, and that'll make you feel better.
It's sort of funny to me, but I like that you have said this a couple of times. Like, if you want to feel better, eat real foods and drink water. You know, we'll say this a bunch more times, I'm sure, in the time that we're talking, but it's funny that we, maybe as Americans or we as individuals, we hear these things and go,
but
the pill? Or what about if I just don't eat for 5 days? Or what if I hang upside down
what
and whatever
really
the thing is?
Really speed it up.
Why do you think these quick fixes are so attractive to folks?
Gosh, yeah, I don't know. I think a big thing is I think people want a magic pill. And I think, I don't even think it's people's fault. I think it's just a lot of times, you know, when you have like a sore throat, you go get a pill for it. And when you have any sort of infection, you go get a pill for it. And I think some people think that translates over to diet, and it's just not how it works. And I don't think it's communicated very well within the media and everything, which is why I try to step up and talk a lot more about it. And it's just, unfortunately, things with diet and what you're eating, those things just take a longer time period. And yeah, like you said, it isn't that complicated. It's just making healthy choices, drinking more water, eating more fruits and vegetables, eating lean proteins and whole grains. But it takes a while to feel better off of it. And there's really no magic pill that you can just eat from food and it'll feel better instantly, unfortunately.
So Isla, as a registered dietitian, you know, we've been talking about detox diets and how that just doesn't work. You've reminded us of the basics of drinking lots of water, eating fruits and vegetables, lean proteins, whole grains. But now I want to ask you about the overall kind of approach to health and wellness, which is the real question that fuels this $33 billion sort of weight loss industry. Is there a diet currently popular or trending that you are in favor of?
No. I think something that I always recommend is just being in a calorie deficit. And I do feel like that's gaining popularity, but I hope it's not seen as a fad, because that's really just everything is based off of a calorie deficit. But all these diets try to do it in a very complicated way. And when you get down to the roots of it, that's all that these diets are really doing, is it's just like, you know, calories in versus calories out. And so just trying to figure out what your calories should be to maintain your body weight, and eating less than that can really take away all those food rules. You get to pick whatever foods you want to eat within those calories, so you don't have to worry about eating tons of fat or like not eating at certain times of the day or crazy things like that. You just pick whatever you want to eat within those calories, and that's really what I recommend, and I hope that does become more popular.
Is it because it's math that we refuse it, you know? That we're just like, boring math, wait, so if I take in less,
divided by two.
You know, all these things, we just sort of reject it. We're like, yeah, there's got to be something else besides math at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's what it is, and I think, again, like I said, it's just not fast. It's not fast as some of these other diets, but I would say, like, whenever you have fast weight loss, it's likely not going to stick, because it means you've probably been way too restrictive in it, and that's what's caused you to lose a lot of weight quickly, and then people gain it back. So instead, by just doing a calorie deficit, it is slower and I think a little bit less attractive in that way, but a lot of times it's a lot more long-lasting.
How much do you think that sleep and other ways of taking care of our body play into this?
Oh, my gosh, so much. I always say that there's so many other things besides what you eat that affect what you eat. So sleep is a huge one. If you're not sleeping enough, you increase your hunger hormones. So it kind of causes you to be more hungry the next day if you don't realize that's the connection. But also increases stress hormones. And when you're more stressed out, your body will hold on to more fat by increasing a cortisol response. So sleeping, stress, drinking enough water, all those things, again, those basics that aren't very fun, they play such a huge part in maintaining your weight.
Are there other quick fix diet fads out there that you're particularly concerned about that we stay away from?
I think one that I am worried about kind of is intermittent fasting. I thought it would kind of go away at this point. And I don't know if it's just mostly I work with millennial women. When I see, and I it's always kind of like teetering the line between, is this like disordered eating? Is it, what is this going on? And so I think that intermittent fasting can kind of perpetuate that, because there's these times where it's like, eat whatever you want and don't eat anything. And to me, that's kind of like a little bit of like getting into scary territory between like overeating and then undereating. And so I hope that one kind of goes away, because it's hard to kind of out-talk those things, because for some reason people are holding on to it. But that one I am a little bit concerned about because of that.
There are positive benefits, though, of intermittent fasting, though, if I understand. Like, if you're able to eat a balanced and regular diet to give your body that break to process those things, that does have benefits?
So I think there's a small maybe amount of benefits. I try to keep updated on the research, and I haven't seen a whole lot that outweighs again those basics. Like it's very yeah, there might be a small amount, but at the end of the day, as long as you're eating with your calories and you're not overeating in general, it's pretty much going to be the same benefits as you doing intermittent fasting. Like I said, if you're eating your fruits and vegetables, if you're eating within your deficit, if you're eating and drinking enough water, it's kind of the same amount of benefits.
And you say that you focus on coaching weight loss for millennials. Why is that? Is there a difference between dieting for younger versus older people?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So first, older people, if you've, or especially for women, if you're older and you've already gone through menopause, it is a lot harder to lose weight because your metabolism slows down. So it's a little bit easier to work with millennials. You still definitely can lose weight if you're older. It's just a little bit of a longer process. But I also just have it in my heart to help millennials, because as millennials go through so many changes as young adults, since that's the age we're at right now, getting graduating college, getting your first job, getting married, having kids, all these things. Every life change interrupts your routine. And when you interrupt your routine, you're likely to sometimes respond by eating more or changing how you eat. So a lot of times I'm hearing like, well, you know, I just got married and I'm moving in with my husband and he eats like a lot of food. And now I don't know what to do because I have to deal with brownies being in the house at all times. So I really enjoy navigating those young adults through those transitions of life.
So how can we lose weight and not do anything different?
Still eat that tray of brownies he's really getting at.
And overeat at that. Not just the tray of brownies, but also anything else in our fridge. As you meet with clients, I'm sure that you get some element of that. Like, they're like, yeah, the math makes sense. But also, can I not change anything, please?
Yeah, I do. Though, sometimes I'll get people who are super motivated, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, let's go to the gym. And they're like, yeah, well, it's just like too cold today, so I'm not going to do that until next month. I'm like, okay, well, you know, let's be realistic with our goals then, because I don't know if you're going to lose much weight until next month. I think like smaller changes for sure. Whenever all those things seem really hard, all these things you have to do to be able to lose weight, the working out, the eating enough fruits and vegetables, making sure in a deficit, don't overeat at social events, all of it can seem overwhelming. And so just trying to break things down into really small steps, even if they don't seem like they're going to do much in that moment, when you build on it, you know, one walk a day may turn into eventually 1 hour workout session in like 3 months because you've worked on that motivation. So that's how I kind of handle those situations.
So what's the good first step? Is it drinking more water? Would that be the first step? Is it going on a walk every day? Where would you say, if people are looking to start just one thing, what would you have them do?
I think the first thing is non-diet related. I think the first thing is making sure your mental health is in check.
Oh, wow.
Making sure, like you said, you're sleeping enough. Yeah, because a lot of times people don't realize how much anxiety and depression and all those things, they affect your nutrition so much. And no matter how much education I give, it can't undo if you feel bad about yourself or if you're so anxious and that's the reason you're overeating all the time. Working with a mental health professional, I always recommend. And once you have that straightened out, I can give you the education piece, but no diet is going to outdo your anxiety if that's what's causing you to overeat. So I always say that's the first step, is addressing those situations.
Well, thank you so much, Isla, for speaking with us about how there's no quick fixes, but basic nutrition that's going to make us healthier in the long run. We appreciate your time.
You're so welcome. Have a good one.
Isla Garcia is a registered dietitian who provides weight loss coaching for millennials. To learn more, you can go to her blog at themillennialnutritionist.com.
Coming up, we're going to tell you why making music may be a more reliable career choice than we previously thought, and in your morning buzz. You listen to the Lisa Show and you think, that's my people. Lisa and I, we could be besties, BFFs, if you will. Well, a movie recommendation for all y'all who think like Lisa. That's coming up in your Morning Buzz.
You're to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show. And after a year in the pandemic, doesn't it feel weird when you see a group of people without masks on? Well, in 20 minutes, we're going to get some tips for handling the shock of things going back to normal so we can do it a little bit better. But first, we got your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that people are talking about. Were we to ever have water cooler talk ever again?
It's going to happen.
I mean, it's rolling out. Let's be fair.
We can look forward to it.
I see the water cooler here in our building, and there is no water cooler talk being had.
No, not yet.
It's people going, when did we get a water cooler? Has that always been there?
That's a new thing.
What is this building that we've been coming back to? The future host of Jeopardy.
Yes.
He said with a gigantic question mark, is it Aaron Rodgers, former quarterback from the Green Bay Packers? No, he's filling in right now.
Oh.
And people are having a good time. They're ribbing him a little bit.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because without getting into too much sports ball history, there was, there was a big game, as in the Super Bowl, a few years back, where at the end they decided to go for a field goal, and they should not have gone for a field goal. The person in Final Jeopardy didn't actually know what the question would be, and so decided to say, who decided to pick that you should go for a field goal? And everyone snickered at Aaron Rodgers' behalf. That was a lot of sports ball. I just was going to say Aaron Rodgers may be the future host of Jeopardy. He loves it, so why not? Maybe. I don't think that he's fan beloved enough to do that. Also in sports, so go ahead and let your eyes gloss over.
No, I want to learn.
NCAA basketball championship occurred last night. It was Gonzaga, depending on what part of this country you're from, versus Baylor, or Baylor, depending on which part of this country you're from. Baylor won, so go Baylor.
Okay.
They are your champions.
Great.
Baylor. It's the Baylor Bears.
Oh, nice.
It's really fun to do plosive
I
B's
love a good
with your Baylor.
Alliteration.
Yeah. And then finally this, if you listen to the show and you think, you know, Lisa and I, we could hang out. We could be besties.
Totally. She,
if I ever met her in real life. Well, I have a movie recommendation for you.
Yeah?
It is a 6-hour long movie about Ernest Hemingway.
Oh,
and
interesting.
It's the latest from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Novick?
Uh-huh.
It is 6 hours of Hemingway. Now,
he's an interesting character, I'm going to tell you.
A lot going on, so...
A lot.
So...
I have opinions already.
Oh, well, I'm sure. You save those opinions for your best friends that would watch a 6-hour documentary about Ernest Hemingway with you.
Oh, but the Ken Burns documentaries? Yeah. Come
sure.
on.
No, they're great.
They're awesome.
6 hours, that's 25% of a day. I just want to throw that out there. It's called, appropriately, Hemingway.
Oh.
So you can find it wherever you stream those great videos. And think about, you know, looking across the room and being like, what do you think about that, Lisa?
Yeah. Well, I talk to the TV, so you would never have to wonder that.
That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. The emotional impact a movie can have on its viewers is undeniable, and a big part of that has to do with the music playing throughout the film. Of all the tiny details that go into making each frame of a scene, it can be argued that music is the most influential feature. Just try to imagine the movie Titanic without the song My Heart Will Go On.
You know what?
I
do not want to live in a world where there is a Titanic movie without My Heart Will Go On.
You know, and there's so many, if you think about your favorite films, music associated with each one. But who decides what music goes into a movie, and how do they find and pick the right songs? Well, today we've invited music supervisor Mike Turner on the show to give us a behind-the-scenes look at his career in music, scoring, and the psychology behind audio simulation. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you guys. So, yeah, it's a big topic. There's a lot to know about music supervision.
So for those who are not yet familiar with it, what exactly do music supervisors do? What are their responsibilities?
And
what do
how
you
do I
love?
Get, I know. How do I get this job?
Right.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people ask me that, actually. Well, so at its most broad, music supervisors basically run the music department on a production. So it can be everything from, finding the right composers, managing the budget, anything has to do with legal compliance, and then, of course, the stuff that I think most people associate with music supervision, finding the right songs mm-hmm. for the right scenes and licensing those things. At the end of the day, everything is up to the director. It's the director's decision, but I'm there running that side of the production, providing them with creative options and, doing all of the sort of behind the scenes work that they aren't doing so that when they're ready to make a decision, everything is ready for them and they can say, yes, I like that. No, I don't like that.
It sounds just such a creative job. And I think that people don't understand the breadth of it as well. It's not like going through, Spotify and picking out songs that you like. You mentioned the one point of legal compliance and things like that. What music is available when you set out to score a movie that people might not consider?
Yeah, most of it just comes down to money. Songs are expensive, and, the more famous the song is and the bigger the artist is, the more it costs. And, movies are a variety of budgets. Some are, hundreds of millions of dollars and the money's not an issue, and others are on a much tighter shoestring. So, for me, a lot of times, I'm working on, indie movies that are maybe $5 to $20 million films, which is considered very low by Hollywood standards when Marvel movies are made for $400 million and things like that. So, when it comes to films at that budget level, it can be a challenge to find songs that the director likes that you can afford, because a song can cost a few $100,000 or, maybe it's only a few $1,000s. But at the end of the day, the right song fits in the scene and everybody just kind of feels it. So I don't think it necessarily has to be an expensive hit famous song to work, but a lot of times that's what directors and producers gravitate towards. So there's sometimes a push and pull with creative versus budget. And it's my job to sort that out and kind of make everybody happy, finding the right creative choices, but the ones that we can afford. And then, of course, negotiating all those rights with the record labels, publishers, agents, managers, artists, making sure everyone gets paid and the licenses are done properly and no one gets sued.
Hey, so I would be curious, where this is sort of your bread and butter and, your livelihood. Tell me about a movie that you've watched where you're like, the movie was so great and the music was so off.
Oh man, interesting. I might risk throwing somebody under the bus.
Yeah.
I know, and
it's
always tricky because it's a very relationship driven.
All right. Then let me back it out a little bit. tell me about what about that music made that movie not work, and you can be vague so we can get an idea of the importance of what you're talking about.
Here's what I'll say about that. Music supervisors sometimes get undue credit for creating great soundtracks when the director also has great taste and is very easy to work with. And sometimes we get undue criticism for terrible soundtracks where it really wasn't up to us. And, we had to carry out marching orders for, someone that maybe didn't have really inspired taste in music. So it's one of those things where, you're painting somebody else's house in the color that they ask you to paint it in.
Well
and
said.
Sometimes, yeah. And so, it's really my job to fulfill their creative direction, because it's their movie. They have a sound in mind. And when it's best when they both align and we really click. And those are the creative relationships that I really enjoy. And sometimes they do lean on you heavily as what to do, and they give you a lot of latitude. And other times it's here's what I want, here's the money to get it, go make it happen. I'd say I've been lucky that in the project that I've worked on, it tends to most of my films and shows is kind of 50-50. There's always spots where I disagree, where I wish I could put this great song in and I just know it's so good and they just aren't feeling it. And I'm like, you're dumb. This is the best choice. But, usually at the end of the day, when it all comes together, it's cohesive, because film in particular tends to be very auteur driven. So you're seeing the film the way the director sees it, and that includes the way it sounds. So
Okay, so on the flip side of that, give us a couple of examples of films or shows that we might be familiar with that where you feel like the music accompanying it is just perfect.
Yeah. Gosh, I really thought that Euphoria on HBO is fantastic. My friend Jen Malone is the music supervisor on that, and she did a really amazing job. And the artist Labyrinth did the score and a lot of original music on that. And I just thought that the convergence of, you know, the picture and sound on that in particular was just really, it just worked so well. It was so moody and cool. And those are the kinds of projects that I love to get, like those sort of weird, off-kilter, moody, arty kind of things like that. I also thought La La Land was really great. That was a unique one.
Oh, good examples. We are lucky enough to talk with Michael Turner about music supervising.
For movies. And I find this topic so interesting because my mind immediately goes to like those breakout kind of songs from movies, like the resurgence, right? Like
or they become popular because of where they're placed in the movie.
Yeah, for instance, there's a fascinating story with the original Wayne's World and Bohemian Rhapsody, right? A perfectly great song by Queen that had sort of had its rise and fall with Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody. But Mike Myers said, no, that we need to have this song that they play in the car. The director of the film was like, no, absolutely not. Let's not do that song. And Mike Myers was like, hey, trust me. I know. Let's go for it. And now name a person who listens to Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen who doesn't towards the end of that song start headbanging like they did in the movie Wayne's World.
Yeah, it's so true. That song was given a whole new lease on life because of that movie. It became, I think it was a bigger hit the second time around after that film. I don't think it was as big a hit when it originally came out on the record. It became like a bigger hit like years later because of that movie. And it can definitely, that happens. I mean, that not only can you give new life to older songs, same thing happened with the show Glee with But Don't Stop Believing became another
hit
from
again Journey.
After Glee. Yeah. But also, of course, it can really create careers for smaller artists who, you know, maybe just get the perfect placement in the right show or film at the right time. And suddenly everybody becomes aware of them. And it's so hard to cut through the clutter, you know, as an independent artist. You know, there's just so much music out there. And sometimes that's what it takes. It could be a commercial or a movie. And I love it when that happens. You know, I just think it's such a neat phenomenon. And by the same token, like, you know, a lot of times when you're working with a director, they have a very specific song in mind for things because they wrote the movie and it's always been in their head that way. And for various reasons, legal or financial, sometimes you just can't get those songs. And it can be a really difficult sort of teeth pulling process to have to replace it. But I really love it when you're able to do that. And then at the end of the process, they like the thing that you brought to the table even better than their original
idea. Must be satisfying.
Yeah. And then to the audience that sees this for the first time, they never knew what was in that director or writer's head. So it's new to them. So they only ever know it that way with the choice that you made. So it's always, you know, the right choice to them because they've never known it any other way.
Give us an idea. Yeah. You sort of queued it up and I would be curious, that independent artist or that not known individual that got their shot through a movie or TV and now is maybe more of a household name.
Yeah. You know, that I think the heyday for that was probably I think the early 2000s. There was a bunch, like Apple did a bunch of commercials for iPods that launched some careers. I think like the band Jet, Are You Gonna Be My Girl, that song became so huge because of that Apple commercial. You know, I'm trying to think of like recent examples from films.
Yeah.
I'm kind of
Well, I like to put people on the spot, and that's a great example.
Yeah,
I remember those early iPod. Kid, ask your parents what an iPod is.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, honestly, right now, like that song became so huge from that commercial, and it's since then is constantly in temp cuts for stuff that I have to replace. I'm working on trying to get rid of that song from a movie right now because it's so expensive. It's like, you know, it's going to be in there for 30 seconds and I don't want to spend $100,000 on that song. And we've, you know, we've all heard that a million times. Let's find the next jet and put it there. But the director loves it, of course, because it's like, it, you know, it's stuck in your head. We all know this song. Mm-hmm. Or actually, here's another recent example. That song by DJ Shadow and Run the Jewels, Nobody Speak. It's pretty like kind of menacing but cheeky rap music. Mm-hmm. And it always gets temped in like heist scenes. And it's so expensive now because everybody's used that song in the biggest movies. But it's so catchy and so like fun and kind of scary at the same time. And yeah, it's tough to find that combination of like menacing and kind of funny. And I'm trying to replace that song in a movie right now, too. It's tough.
Oh, funny. All these like kind of replacement songs that you're searching for. Is that how you spend the majority of your day? Walk us through a day in a life of a music supervisor.
Yeah, a lot of it is. I mean, it all depends on the project. Sometimes it's more about finding songs. Sometimes it's more about creating songs or, you know, working with composers on original music and that kind of stuff. But I think the thing that most people think of when they think of music supervisor is finding, you know, pre-existing songs, you know, creating a compilation, basically. So the editor and the director, when they take their first pass on something, they just put in, you know, to the cut anything that they feel works at the time. So they're not thinking about logistics or budget or anything. They just need, you know, music.
We want this
feel.
Right
to the scene. Yeah, exactly. And that's the easiest process for them. I usually try to get in as early as possible and in advance send a bunch of music that I think they'll like that is probably within our budget scope so that when they're grabbing for things that hopefully they'll pull from some of that and I have to do less work later. But
yeah.
It's always the case that, you know, if we have like, $500,000, let's say, to spend on a soundtrack and big expensive songs can sometimes cost $100,000 or $200,000. That's going to go really fast if you've got three of those or four of those in your movie all of a sudden, right? Mm-hmm. And if I've got 20 spots to fill, I can't spend $100,000 a song.
Yeah. So expensive.
So, right. Yeah. So you're always fighting at some point with what they call temp love, which is where, you know, the director puts a Rolling Stones song in to a scene and falls in love with it and nothing else will do. Because it just works so great. And of course, like, we all love the Rolling Stones. And it's like, you know, you've made your Scorsese moment there. Like, how
right.
can you compete with
right.
that? Then, yeah.
Well,
and I have to figure out a way to do that.
That sounds like, in some ways, one of the best jobs. And in some ways, like, how do you replace a Rolling Stones song? It sounds like almost an impossibility. Michael Turner, if you ever need a duo to do a cover of a song,
we're
Lisa
here.
And I can Are You Gonna Be My Girl anytime. And you're gonna be Are You Over Here?
Yeah.
It's Are You Gonna
Yes.
No, you're too high.
We'll do it.
You can always
nice.
Reach out to us. We're more than willing to do a horrible rendition
yeah.
of whatever song you might need for that film. Mike Turner is a music supervisor who has supervised a variety of projects, including series for CBS, Netflix, Hulu, Fox News, and many more. You can learn more about him by going to his website, which is MikeTurnerMedia.com. Thanks for being on the show.
How do you manage the reverse culture shock now that the world's going back to normal after COVID-19? Well, we're coming up next talking about it.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
We've all experienced a shift from normalcy this past year. And at first it seemed like we'd be rid of COVID-19 by Easter of 2020, but we weren't. We were not.
Yeah. How naive were we, huh?
Listen, we were full of hope for a while.
July 2020, yeah. This will be gone. Sure.
So many of us have had to adopt new habits, schedules, and even new jobs. And now the pandemic feels a part just of our everyday normal lives. So it's incredible how quickly we all adapted to a new reality. But what do we do now that things are going back to how they were before COVID, you know, BC, as some people are now calling it? What if some people still wear masks? What if some people don't. I mean, that is one example of how things may change and look different moving forward. Some of us might experience a little reverse culture shock. Is this something that you worry about, Richie?
Oh, it's something that I am curious about.
Yeah?
As we live, where we live, the government endorsed mandate for masks expires this Saturday. Mm-hmm. And I am very curious to see how people behave. In the words of our governor, he said something to the effect of, if the business that you go into asks you to wear a mask, don't be a jerk.
It's
the governor who said this. He says, you know, don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
Wear a mask.
Yeah.
If someone wants to have space from you, allow them to have space from you. They are human beings that, you know, deserve your kindness and your respect.
There are a lot of conversations popping up in friend groups and in families about what things may look like and how things feel weird. It's this idea of moving forward, maybe in a less confident way than we have before, that gets us to talk about reverse culture shock. So we thought it was very beneficial to have a conversation about this. So joining us today to talk with us is Dr. Deborah Mashek. Welcome, Deborah.
Good morning, Lisa and Richie. Thanks for having me back.
So first of all, we talk about this idea of reverse culture shock. What is it really?
You know, the term originated with State Department employees who were having these, you know, times where they had to be out abroad for a couple of years. And it's really about the stress of returning home after an extended time away. And of course, it's not just state employees who experience this, but also missionaries, study abroad students, Peace Corps volunteers, those who literally make a new home somewhere else and then at some point need to return home back to the U.S. Is the frame that is often used here.
So how will people, in your opinion, experience reverse culture shock when things start going back to how they were before COVID across the country?
Right. So we have this great reopening that's starting to happen. And I'm noticing it in myself where I happen to live in New York and I went out last week with my kiddo. And there's already a lot of variance in terms of the people, like you were saying, are wearing the masks. But it was also, I found myself crossing the street earlier than I normally would to avoid people who were coming toward me. Hmm. And they're just little behavior shifts that are happening. And when we think about going back into the workplace, there'll be things like, how do I deal with my coworker who chews really loudly that I haven't had to think about for the past year or so?
I haven't thought of that.
Or how do I make small chat, you know, when we're sitting around the conference table, as opposed to when somebody hits the start meeting on the Zoom button, where there are all these little moments that we haven't had to experience. A lot of us haven't had to experience for the past year, though, granted, not everybody has had the luxury of being able to work from home, mm-hmm. which I think is also important to hold in mind here, is that a lot of people will be going through this transition, but not necessarily everybody.
Well, and a unique situation for some where we have been considered vital, I guess, it sounds silly as I say that, but we've come into the office, that is Lisa and I, but the majority of our building has not been here. So we have seen each other and been able to work together and interact throughout the day.
And we're just as awkward as ever, I must say.
but as we see other people coming back into the office, there's an interesting sort of culture shock change for us as well, where it's like, we're doing this meeting in person now. Well, it was a lot better when I could Zoom it from my car, but we'll sit down and do this with you.
I'd venture to guess too. Sorry to interrupt there, Richie. I'd venture to guess too that you all have maybe taken up a little bit more space than before because you haven't had to navigate as many people, or you might have become more comfortable just kind of shouting across of like, "Hey, Lisa, I got to tell you this thing." I get this vibe from you too.
That's exactly what's happened.
Apparently, we're transparent. I didn't know that.
My question is that as everyone is really experiencing this across the country on different levels, what are those things that we need to keep in mind to really show that respect and kindness to those who are dealing with this cultural shift differently than we are?
So first of all is the curiosity about your own experience of it. So when you notice you are feeling uncomfortable or you're craving something, maybe it's the human connection, the hugs that so many of us are missing, to first of all, notice those feelings, to see if you can name them, what's the need behind them, that sort of thing. But then also be curious about other people's reactions. They are a different person, obviously, and ask them, how are they doing? How has this reentry been for you? What do you need to feel comfortable right now? And I think another thing that comes to mind is giving each other permission to do this in our own way. So, you know, I personally would not want to go back 5 days a week right away. That would feel like kind of like scuba divers getting the bends by going too deep too fast. I would prefer, can we try going back for 1 day or maybe 2 days and see if you can taper into the full experience again? Part of what was so dang jarring about when everything shut down is that it happened really, the world shut down in a matter of, what was it, maybe 72 hours, where just everything got canceled.
It was so fast.
It was so fast, which, you know, we're very adaptable creatures, but, you know, give us a little time to adapt.
Which I think is a good note for anyone who's listening who are employers, right? When they think about, okay, we're going to bring people back to the office, sort of an onboard process, as opposed to June 1st, everyone shall report back, like, hey, we're gonna work into this, you know, a 3 day, a 2 day a week, a 4 day a week from the office kind of thing, and being able to bring people along rather than just it was how it was, now it is how it is, let's push forward.
Richie, I agree 100%, because the other thing to remember is kids are also going back to school around, you know, in different communities, the rhythms, of course, are different. But if you are an employer and you have parents on your team, then they're navigating this whole other transition back at home also, and giving as much space for people to be their whole selves, I think is going to be critical for employee retention and satisfaction.
Now, Dr. Deborah Mashick, we've been talking a little bit about this idea of reverse culture shock and how it is really awkward. And we've offered a few solutions, but now I would love to be able to really hone in on some doable things that we can do to kind of ease in to this new change and way of life in a way that will really help everyone feel a little bit more confident. Because as we mentioned before, you know, people don't know what to do. And so we have a lot of awkward starts and stops. Are there other things like easing into a work schedule that we can do to make people feel a little bit more comfortable?
Yeah, you know, one of these, and this is borrowed directly from strategies that, you know, I would talk with when I was a professor, I would talk with my students about as they were coming back from study abroad, is think about what are the anchors from your current situation, so say from work from home, that you could pull forward. So they might be habits or new rituals or little pieces of your daily routine that you really have come to enjoy and embrace, and figure out how can you carry those forward. So for me, I remember the first day from work from home, I posted on Facebook how excited I was that I got to have coffee out of my favorite coffee mug, as opposed to grabbing a to-go cup at the deli and, you know, racing off to the commute. That coffee mug, as silly as it sounds, has become this little anchor for me that I plan to continue. Like, you know what? I can wake up 20 minutes earlier. I can have my dang coffee in my mug. That's important to me. So find a little totem. The other thing is to take some reflection time now before you are heading back to say, what is it that you miss about your office or about your commute or about those lunches when you got to go, you know, have this special over at the, you know, the diner across the street, and see if you can go into a savoring experience for those things now and help you kind of reactivate that longing that there is something to look forward to. We talked about being gentle with yourself and others and about being curious about tapering, but also look for opportunities to really be in relationship with other people who are going through that transition. So, you know, maybe you had somebody that you loved going to lunch with at work. Get that on the schedule now. Be like, can we have a reboot lunch and just check in with each other there? And then, of course, I mentioned this idea that your family might also be going through this transition. So as much as you can for your friends, for your family, and including for your employees, try to be the sturdy container for them, that whatever they're experiencing is okay. So look out for words like, if you say, well, you should do this, or you shouldn't do that, or you must do this, none of that's actually true. Those are all, you know, narratives that we tell ourselves. So see if you can erase those words from your vocabulary during this transition, just to give space to everybody, including yourself, for doing this in your own way.
I like the discussion of anchors being able to pull those things from this time forward. I would be curious about that. I have anxiety that they won't allow me to wear my pajamas into the future here to the office. I've been able to because Lisa says, I don't care. I don't even look at you. But I'm curious, as other people get in, is that a feasible option, do we think? Or are there some things that I'm just going to have to let
go
of?
Why are you wearing that? It's my anchor.
Yeah.
It's my emotional support pajama.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's an angle.
Ooh, and it sounds medical, so they can't deny it.
Well, okay, but what if everybody is actually missing their pajamas, and that could be a fun, like, okay, let's have pajama day. What the heck? Why not try it as a goofy thing? Yeah, ideally, it should have full coverage and all that good stuff. But you know, I think there are ways to do it, or you know, get a T-shirt that says these are actually my pajamas. I don't know, but I'm sure there will be boundaries, though.
Well, and I appreciate that you have a good attitude about it and a good sense of humor, because I think that could be a very helpful tool as well of recognizing the awkward and the uncomfortable situations and just acknowledging that we're going through a time of transition instead of trying to deny it all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, how many people have you kind of passed right now where you're thinking, wow, can I give them a hug? Do I not? Do I do a foot bump? Are we supposed to touch elbows? And I have no idea. So I just at this point say, I would love to give you a hug. I'm not going to, but know that I'm holding you.
Oh, that's very sweet. And it acknowledges it.
Well, and what I like about what you said is, although the pajama thing is sort of a joke, some days I wear actual pants. That is a thing that, like, when people are looking at coming back to an office, they think, oh, one of the things that I really liked was being able to spend time with my spouse before we started working. Mm-hmm. How many people... Let me actually rephrase that. As there will be a lot of people that coming through this will find what they were doing, you know, pre-pandemic or even during the pandemic is not going to work for them as they return or are asked to return to an office. What sort of advice do you have for those folks that recognize that this is a pivotal transition point?
You know, I think it's realizing that there is grief involved too, that there is going to be sadness, and recognizing that and again honoring it, and don't be afraid to share that with other people. Like, I'm really going to miss you know, this extra time with my family. I am going to miss the comfortable dress, all those sorts of things. And again, recognizing it allows us to experience that full range of emotion, and that full range of emotion is actually very healthy.
What about those who are feeling just overwhelmed by everything, by the state of the world, really? And it all seems to be such an intense time. Are there healthy coping skills people can use to really cope with feelings of being overwhelmed?
Absolutely. I am a big fan of any sort of mindfulness meditation, and there are a lot of free apps available that help you with that, or YouTube videos you can stream that have to do with a lot of centering and just going inside and respond, you know, experiencing those emotions, and then also realizing that they are temporary, that kind of the sun's still behind the clouds, that sort of metaphor. Getting support from friends, obviously, but also mental health professionals. So finding a therapist or a counselor can be really helpful at this point. And also journaling, get those ideas out, get those feelings out. And I know a lot of us are on social media, and it at times becomes this de facto form of journaling and chronicling our lives. And just a fun little story, at the 1-year anniversary of my work from home, I went back and looked at all of my COVID-related posts over the years, or over the whole year. I thought I was in chaos for about 6 months, but according to the documentation I had on Facebook, it was about 3 weeks. So our experience of time can actually get really distorted. So journaling or finding some other way of chronicling what this reentry experience has been like for you can over time become a tool or a resource that you can turn back to get in touch with the experience, but also your growth.
What tips do you have for those people who, on the flip side, are just done and just want to move on from this period of their life, stop talking about it, no more masks, we're just done, and want to move on?
Well, again, you know, it's exciting. You can be there, you can do that. But as your governor was saying, I think it was your governor, you know, be respectful of what other people are experiencing and what their needs are too. And of course, none of this is a you're right, I'm wrong sort of situation. It's that we all have needs, desires, interests, and to the extent that we can navigate those for ourselves, but also out of respect for others, the better the world's going to be.
As we talk about sort of a timeline with this, I know that there's going to be specific sort of results for each individual, right, as to how long this will take. But at what point, if someone is still struggling, should they seek professional help?
Yeah, it's a great question. So if there, you know, a lot of the time it's about if it extends past a couple weeks, or if you notice significant impairment in your daily life, so you're not able to sleep or you're not able to eat, or you're withdrawing from all social interaction, you don't want to see anybody, reach out. You're not alone. You don't have to go through this alone.
Awesome. Dr. Deborah Mashick is the founder of MICO, which helps higher education, nonprofit, and philanthropic leaders advance complex collaborative initiatives. You can get more information at MICO.consulting and download MICO's 20-page guide to effective collaboration. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Mashick.
My pleasure.
It's an interesting idea. And the overall theme that I keep coming back to that I feel like begs repeating is that we need to be kind and have really good manners about this situation. Mm-hmm. When we walk into someone's home and into someone's business, we need to be respectful about their level of comfort. It's not just about us making our point.
Well, and really, like when you think about it, it really should always be a little more outward, right?
Yeah.
Like you say that, it's like, it shouldn't just be about us. And it's like, I don't know that
it should ever really be.
All about us. But yeah, sort of wandering halls and opportunities that I've had to be around other groups of people. It is a fascinating social observance to see how some people are like, hoax, let's do it. I'm in. You know, I'm vaccinated. You know, we're
don't you always see the, like, are we hugging? Can we hug? What's happening?
Right.
And if you would have shown a video of somebody doing that interaction, you know, a year and a half ago, we would be like, what is this?
Yeah.
What's happening? It's that little dance. I find myself doing the air hug a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just a normal thing where one arm is up higher, the other one's in, and I just move them back and forth. Air hug. I want to hug you. So I'm just going to pretend like if someone were videoing me, sending it to me in the past, I would have been like, what has she done now?
it begs the question, and unfortunately, we don't have time to get into it now, but individually, what is it going to be for you to sort of return to that hugging and having people over? Is it once you're past, you know, your vaccination time and you know that the people that you're interacting with, will you have those questions and conversations?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a date on the calendar that you're like, I'm over it, June 1st, and I'm going back to, like, how will we navigate the future? It's a fascinating, we don't have enough time for a conversation.
Yeah, but knowing we can all be kind, we have that within our power. Now, coming up, how do you handle conflict at work without escalating it? Are you good at it? We're going to help you coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Hi, this is Lisa.
Hey, it's me, Richie T.
To do it. You know what's good for you?
A bunch of things that I can do for the weekend.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Does the daily news make it hard to have faith in humanity? Well, coming up in 20... Stop laughing. Yeah, well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to find out what one organization is doing to make sure we raise a new generation of true leaders.
Tom Hiddleston fans, unite. We have something we need to watch today.
Oh.
2 minutes and 31 seconds of pure joy. I'll tell you about it coming up in your morning buzz.
No matter how we try to avoid it, conflict is just a normal part of our lives.
No, it's not.
I kind of knew you were going to do that.
Thank you.
Because conflict is that predictable.
Yeah.
All right? It's inevitable that we're going to fight with our siblings, our parents, our friends, our significant others, right? You're going to it's going to happen.
It's interesting. You say conflict and you also say fight. And I don't think conflict and fight are the same thing.
That's an interesting idea. Not all of us deal with conflict in the same way, right? And some don't even couch it in the same terms. So knowing that people do handle conflict in a different way, right? Some people ignore it. Some people seek it out. Some people lean into it. What does this difference in approaching conflict, where does it come from? How does it influence us? How does it shape our lives and our relationships? Well, here to tell us a little bit about the different conflict styles is social ethicist Melody Stanford Martin. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lisa and Richie.
When we talk about conflict styles, what does that mean?
So many of us have a dormant or a default conflict style that we go to based on the ways that we were socialized. So I've identified styles. You might find styles.
Hey, Melody, we're going to put you on. Melody, we're going to put you on hold real quick, and we're going to try and get reconnected with you. Your phone is cutting in and out, and we want to make sure that we hear the things that you're saying. It's just really difficult. We'll try and get reconnected, and we'll come right back to you.
When I think about different conflict styles, and we'll get Melody back on the phone to be able to help define them as well, I just immediately think of the different kinds of relationships that I've had, whether they're with friends or a spouse or my kids. And I will think about different difficult situations that we've been in that I would say would be like a fight or a disagreement, and then how we react. So, you know, there's people in my life who will ignore it and not and do anything than talk about it, and other people in my life who will just want to talk about it right then and there, who some come in hot, you know, immediately offended, how others are curious about it and want to talk about it or talk around it. And then it makes me feel of all of those different kinds of conflict styles, which one am I the most comfortable with? And it kind of makes you feel a little uncomfortable, especially if you can be self-critical about the way you handle conflict.
And being able to find your way through a conflict, and that's sort of the difference as we talk about conflict and fight. Uh-huh. Like fight to me is that you never sort of resolve it, right? There's a conflict that either hurts someone's feeling or does damage to whatever that relationship may be. That's sort of how I think of fights. Mm-hmm. When I consider conflicts, I consider those to be, and this has taken a few years and maturity and a couple of, you know, really deep relationships to get to this point. But conflict is just being able to say, you have an opinion, and I am grateful for the opinion and way that you approach this subject, which is going to be different than the way that I come to this. And oh, that we can both learn as we come from, you know, make our way through this problem, that we can both be better on the other side. That's how, in an altruistic and I don't get there very often kind of way, I love that aspect of conflict.
I think we've got Melody back with us. Are you there?
I'm here. Sorry about that.
No, it's good. We want to make sure that we can hear you clearly. So we've been talking about different conflicts, what we think are styles in our experiences. What are the different conflict styles?
Thanks for asking. So there are six styles that I work with in my line of work. So I've identified avoidance, brawlers, conciliators, debaters, devil's advocates, and cooperative. So let me break that down a little bit.
Yeah.
Avoidance are people who tend to run for the hills at any sign of trouble. And it's funny because even though I work as a conflict transformation specialist, I'm a classic avoidant.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that funny? A lot of times people write books based on what they're not good at because they're fascinated by it and want to study it more. And that was the case for me in my line of work. Avoidance tend to run for the hills, right? Deep conflict makes us deeply uncomfortable. Every time we experience it, it feels like a threat. We want to run away and may feel a sense of panic. Brawlers like to throw their dukes up. Richie, when you said, no, I'm not, or no, it's not, I wonder if you're a brawler a little bit.
Wonder no longer. I am the brawler, sometimes for comedic purposes, but most of the time because I can't help myself.
You know, it's sometimes you got to throw the dukes up, right? And brawlers may not always fight fair, and you don't have to disclose whether you do or not. But if that's your default mode, that might be what you go to. A conciliator is someone who tries to resolve things as quickly as possible, sometimes to their own detriment, right? So it might seem like, and certainly all everyone using these styles might mean well, right? It might not mm-hmm. come from a bad place, but it's the ways that we're raised. It's the ways that we're socialized. So conciliators want to pacify the threat as much as possible, even if it means throwing themselves under the bus and not meeting their own needs. Debaters like to intellectualize, right? I can debate too. You can see these issues as kind of this idea cloud above your head that becomes detached from your personal experience. Mm. And debaters might have trouble with vulnerability and intimacy because everything becomes an abstraction versus their own experience. So again, none of these are necessarily wrong, but it's important to know what our default mode is, and I'll go into that in a moment. The other thing about debaters is that some people are better natural debaters than others, and some people have more training in debate. Like if they were in debate club or they have, you know, a friend group who likes to debate a lot, they just have more training and skills. So that can lead to power imbalances in the conflict itself. Hmm. The fifth style is devil's advocates. So and we all have known those folks who just like to be contradictory just for the sake of being contradictory, right?
Yeah.
So a healthy, yeah.
We only laugh because we love.
Exactly. Yeah. And a healthy devil's advocate can use, this is a kind of a tool of empathy, which is funny because you wouldn't think it from the name. You can say, you know, have you thought about this? What about this person's perspective? So using this ability to bring up issues or points of view that need to be considered. An unhealthy devil's advocate will also lack vulnerability sometimes, and they be maybe never willing to come to consensus because they just like being contrary, and that can be really frustrating for the people around them, right?
Yeah.
And then, yep. And then finally, the sixth style is what I call a cooperative. People who understand, and this is actually, I caught the tail end, Richie, of what you were saying earlier. People who understand that conflict is a natural part of life and it's uncomfortable, but it can be an opportunity for massive personal growth for both for us and the people that we're talking to. So even if we can't reach agreement, sometimes working through it, even if we're never going to come to the same point of view, can be an educational opportunity. So cooperatives practice emotional regulation. They don't fight. They don't flee. They just push through with patience and work through it in order to cooperate with the person they're working with. So conflict styles, right? We all have a style or maybe two. And interestingly, in different situations, you might use a different style depending on the situation, right? Depending mm-hmm. on what the situation needs. The problem is we get locked into a style because of the ways we're socialized. What do I mean by socialized? I mean that the ways we grow up. So outside of our personality and our body chemistry and the ways that, you know, we're genetically predisposed, there are so many things.
Oh, there we go.
Can you still hear us?
There we go. Yep.
Thank you. Yep. There are so many things that lead to the way we develop these styles, right? For example, our social world. The cultural influences that impact our race, class, gender, ethnicity, ability, all of these things that locate us in a certain place in the world. Our family systems, the roles that we played in our family of origin, right? Mm-hmm. Were you constantly mediating debates between your siblings? Then you might be a conciliator, right? Mm-hmm. Were you experiencing a lot of conflict between your parents, always arguing? Then you might be an avoidant because you don't want yelling in your home. Right? There's so many different ways that we are impacted by the ways that we're raised. Our past experiences with conflict play a huge role. If you've been deeply hurt by being in conflict with someone, you might not want to go through that again, and that might impact the way you approach it. Our education, what we're taught, what's modeled around us, the adults, the parental figures, the role models, and how they deal with conflict, we pick up all of that. Our media consumption, what we watch and listen to, will have an impact. And finally, the stakes of that impact. If that conflict or issue has a bigger impact on our lives, we might approach it differently than if it's not that big of a deal to us, right? So all to say, we're not stuck with our conflict style. It's largely learned. If it can be learned, it can be unlearned. We can learn healthier patterns. We just need to be more aware and work on it to build those skills.
We're talking with Melody Stanford Martin about conflict styles. You've identified the six in which you feel like each one of us fall into at least one, a couple, as you were describing them. I'm like, yeah, I do that in this particular situation,
yeah.
Or
oh,
I'm definitely more of this, depending on what the interaction is. You've mentioned that a lot of this is learned behavior, and because of that, can be learned out of. How do we do that? That seems not only like one of the most vulnerable things that we could do, but also one of the most difficult.
It is difficult, and I'm glad you said that. And again, I don't want to shame anyone for their style. This is based on years of history that we have walking around on this earth and what we've experienced and what we've been taught. You know, again, as someone who's a classic avoider myself, I had to recognize, wow, some of the things I was taught growing up, that's not the healthiest thing for me. So how about I work on that and learn something new? So let me give three really practical steps to transitioning into a different mindset. And the first, I would say, is unearthing the personal history that caused us to learn that style. And this can be very difficult and very challenging, especially for those of us who've been through hard things. Therapy can be a really vital tool in this process. And again, what I was saying earlier, kind of changing our relationship to conflict, that's my entire work, is helping people realize that conflict doesn't have to be a threat. It can be a set of amazing opportunities for personal growth. And it's difficult, and it's uncomfortable, and it's awkward, but it doesn't have to destroy us. So first, unearthing the personal history that caused us to learn that style, right? Just being aware of what our style is, right? No shame, no blame, but understanding it. Number two, identifying which styles you would like to lean toward, which skills you would like to build, right? And then three, working on those new skills that align with your goals. It seems really straightforward and really common sense. That can be a really long process, but sometimes a lot of us have never given much thought to the style of conflict that we have, right? And if we're not aware, we can't grow. So awareness is key. Identifying our goals is key, and working on those skills that would help us grow in that arena. For example, if you're an avoidant like me and you want to work on being more of a cooperative, then I would work on having the courage and the patience to have difficult conversations and pushing through. What I like to tell people, what I like to recommend as a point of homework is initiate a difficult conversation and set a timer for just 20 minutes. Have that conversation for 20 minutes and then stop and take a break, right? And end on the upswing. See yourself doing it. See yourself not falling apart. Seeing yourself coping with it and regulating your emotions and giving that person the benefit of the doubt. See yourself cooperating with them. See yourself not trying to control them or force an agreement, but succeeding in having that difficult conversation and everything not falling apart. And if you start doing that on a regular basis, you start seeing that pattern of success in yourself. You start seeing, oh, I can do this.
Assuming that we are working on ourselves and our own conflict styles, but obviously we're having relationships with different people who have their own differing conflict styles. How do you deal with that difference when it's with family or close friends?
That is the question of the moment, I think, is a lot of us have been experiencing, you know, conflict and polarization in our families. And that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, actually, a very long struggle of differences of opinion and, you know, things like politics and religion with my family. And it doesn't matter what side who is on at the moment, but talking about the painfulness of that conflict right now, you know, is something that has touched my life personally. And I'm really passionate about helping others with the skills that I've learned. So it's incredibly difficult. And what I've seen in my own journey and my, you know, my graduate work in conflict transformation is that when people work together, they may never agree, but they can start to get somewhere. What happens a lot of times is in these relationships, these difficult relationships, one person wants to work on it and the other person is just coasting and doesn't care, right? Or the other person is distracted or the other person is antagonistic. If you can get to a place where you can both cooperate, work together, right? Even if you never agree, that relationship can start to swing toward a healthier place. So that would be the first thing I would offer. If you are struggling with someone in a difficult relationship and you're both experiencing high levels of conflict, possibly step back and talk to this person. Hey, I don't want this to be my relationship with you. I want a healthier relationship with you. How can you and I put our heads together and work on this together so that not one person is trying to do all the work, because that's usually not very successful.
Melody Stanford Martin, we introduced you as a social ethicist, and I'm curious, what is that?
I get asked that question a lot. So an ethicist is someone who, you know, it's can be very academic and heady. Ethicists work in the realm of moral decisions, right? What's the right way for me to act in the world? What is a moral right choice? Social ethicists take that idea and they apply it to relationships. How do we be in right relationship with each other? How do we build a world that facilitates right relationships? How do we build systems and institutions that facilitate right relationships? So it gets a little theoretical, but I love to write for a general audience because I don't believe that knowledge should stay just in the academy. So I really want to encourage people to think about, how do we build a healthier world together, and how do we have relationships of restoration, of justice, of truth, and of love.
And when you talk about writing, you are the author of the new book, Brave Talk, Building Resilient Relationships in the Face of Conflict, where people can find out more about that online at bravetalkproject.com. We've been visiting with Melody Stanford Martin. Thank you for being on the show with us.
Thanks so much. Can I offer one more thing?
Yes.
I've got a free conversation game on my website that allows people to practice difficult conversations in a structured setting. So if you're really struggling, go check that out. It's currently a free download in beta version, and you can get that at bravetalkproject.com/basecamp.
Maybe we should do that on a future show, Lisa.
Yeah.
I'll have difficult conversations with you. We could download the game. Interested?
I have difficult conversations every day, but I would love to have a difficult conversation with you. No. Now, what does it take to be a really great leader? Well, we're going to talk about it coming up next.
A trailer for something coming to Disney Plus June 11th. Everybody's talking about it. I'm going to highlight it coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Does one of your kids have a hard time managing their mental health? In 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you can do as their parents to support them. But first, we've got your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now. And this first one, you almost wouldn't even believe it. When I saw the headline, I said, oh, I guess we're here.
Oh, really?
Texas Rangers, that is a baseball team. Okay. They sold over 38,000 tickets to their home opener.
Whoa.
Now in the state of Texas, they said, Ollie income free. Not free, they had to buy tickets. Oh. But they said, hey, you know what? We're open. We're doing this baseball thing. Come take you out to the ball game. Let's get here. 38,000 fans in the stands watching baseball in Texas. All eyes on Texas to see how that goes, of course. But that is certainly one of the first major events post-pandemic and looking forward to the future. Also, today is National Jump Over Things Day.
Is it really?
Yeah. So you're looking to celebrate today? Here's a list of things that you could jump over.
It's been a while since I've celebrated this holiday, I'm going to be honest.
You could jump over boxes, people, furniture, potholes.
I feel like you're just...
Puddles.
Listing nouns.
Garbage. Hurdles, horizontal bars, a rope as you're swinging it, a ball as it's being thrown at you, a fence while riding a horse, park benches, playground equipment. Just remember, whatever you do today, you got to jump over it, because it's National Jump Over Things Day. It's the greatest holiday ever.
I never knew.
And then finally, log online, whether it be on your phone responsibly or, during a meeting, during one of those work-from-home meetings. Put it up on the other screen. Loki, that's right, the brand new series from Disney+.
Where have I been? I didn't know that was coming.
Yeah. Loki, we join into the Marvel Universe. Also, I appreciated this in this particular series.
Yeah.
Owen Wilson
really?
Is in the Loki series, and it's your favorite characters and a bunch of time Marvel stuff that I don't understand because I'm a couple movies behind, but millions and millions of people very excited for it. The series Loki comes to Disney Plus on the 11th of June, so look forward to that. That is your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. When was the last time that you talked to a group of teenagers? For me, it's an everyday thing.
Well,
so that's
why
I
ask. Just go home, right? Well, when your kids call me in times of trial, does that count?
No.
When they're all on speakerphone and I'm like, guys, your mom, it's just let her have a break. Just let her go for a run. But actually in a room with a group of teenagers,
yeah.
It's been probably a couple years.
I wonder if we really stop and consider that when we talk to teenagers, we're really talking about the leaders that will impact our futures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. in a way that we really consider that. I mean, instead of sort of pushing them to the side, right?
Yeah, I want to just point out that you are dangerously touching close to saying things like you believe that the children are our future.
I was trying not
teach them well,
to trip you
we
into
can
song
let them
lyrics.
Lead the way. I just want to know that that is where my mind went. But it is true.
It is true. And I do want to make the point that the youth of today are really preparing to face and lead a world that's going to be full of new, complex moral and ethical decisions that will obviously come about with the rise of technology and global policies that we don't know what they are yet. And so knowing that they're going to go into uncharted territories, they need to be ready. Now, and today, we really want to highlight an organization dedicated to empowering underserved youth and helping them become these kinds of leaders that our society is going to need. So to share with us their vision and mission, we actually have the founder of All Leaders Must Serve, Jane Williams. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
So All Leaders Must Serve, what is your mission?
Our mission is we are a mentor organization that empowers young adults ages 15 to 25 to become self-sufficient and to give back to their community. And we do that through mm-hmm. job readiness.
Okay, so talk to us a little bit more about your programs that help that job readiness, that encourage self-sufficiency.
Well, like you said, we are working with an audience that generally have struggled in school. They may have trauma going on at home. They may have a learning disability, but they still are leaders. We believe they're leaders. And so what we do is we start off with a focus on soft skills. And this is something that we're finding a lot of our young people are lacking, even coming out of college, which is the work ethics that help them to be successful in the adult workforce and the living skills that they're going to need. We also focus on character development and communication skills, which both are very necessary to move on from high school into the adult world successfully.
Those soft skills, the work ethic, the living skills, the character development, the communication, what specifically do you do to encourage the development of those skills?
Well, we've written curriculum that has a little bit of psychology mm-hmm. to inspire them, a little bit of information that most of them have never heard before, such as, and you realize that oftentimes these young people don't have models mm-hmm. in their home, so they don't know what it looks like. And so our mentors facilitate the curriculum in a very easy way for them to absorb. We start off with just, you know, doing first, we always start with food because you can't have teenagers.
I was going to say, you know your audience.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. You have to have food and just having fun. And then we go into a business-like setting with very clear agreements that they have signed off on as to behave like like an adult in a business meeting. And we've told them what that looks like. And then we give them all leadership roles in that lesson plan. And so the mentor will facilitate information. They will teach information so that they're all involved, all in discussion, but then they'll go into a small group where now they get to take that information and say, how does that apply to me in my life? And what does that look like? And I will tell you the underlying benefit that we must all provide to our young people is relationship. And so in that small group, relationship building is continued from the very beginning where we're eating together
to now we're having small group discussion about what they just heard and what it really looks like to them. And then we ask them to get up in front of the room and we give them impromptu questions where they are asked to answer questions off the cuff, but they're questions pertaining to what they just heard. This gives us an idea if they absorbed it or if it went over their head and if we need to laugh and repeat, but also applaud them for getting up and doing that. And they become very comfortable speaking in front of a group.
Jane Williams, the founder of All Leaders Must Serve. We're talking about teaching those soft skills to underserved youth. As I hear you speaking, I think this is something that everyone, not just underserved youth, but not just youth, but literally everyone could benefit from the message
that you are
sharing. How is it determined those that will work with your organization?
We actually just go out into the community and we get volunteers. Some of them are retired, some of them are professional, and depending on their work schedule, we put them in a situation or we arrange a session where young people will be in their session. And so the beauty of that is they are sharing their professional experiences along with the curriculum that the young people are being exposed to. And they're talking about the character that is successful. They're talking about not only how to get a job, but how to keep that job and excel in that job because they know they've been there. And the young people are so interested in their stories that they start absorbing that. But even better, once they've gone through our program, they remain as alumni and they can call on their mentors anytime they want. They're in a crunch. And that's why we say 15 to 25, because if they come to us when they're, 18 or maybe a little younger, we're available continually while they're making that journey. And I think this is where we miss our young people. We give them something and then we say, okay, thank you, goodbye.
Yeah.
And they still need our help to continue to make it. So I could give you a quick example.
Please.
And that is, I got a call last week from three of our alumni for the first time have gotten together and moved into an apartment. They are totally self-sufficient for the first time.
Wow.
One's a foster youth that has aged out. One is someone who was homeless when we met her, and one was a couch surfer. So these three have come together. They all are working. They have a work history now. They've been with us for 4 to 6 years, and now they're all moved in together. But guess what? Roommates are, difficult sometimes, and friends are fun, but now we're roommates. And so they'll call me up and they'll say, Miss Jane, we need you to come in and mediate. And so that's what I do. I go in and I say, hey, you guys are family. What's going on here? And let's get these rules down and let's discuss these difficult issues now so that you're successful. The goal is one year together as roommates. And then we'll see what next year looks like.
Wow.
I love it. And it's so encouraging. And it sounds like it's more than a mentoring program. It's making these real connections that last beyond, a certain regular,
length of term of program.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Limited. How many youth do you serve each year?
And you can tell because we get very involved with them, we serve about 30 young people a year, approximately. In 6 years, well, and COVID kind of knocked that down quite a bit.
Sure.
But we've had over 170 kids come to our program.
And someone may hear that and say, that's not very many. But when you consider that you are changing the life and scope of these individuals, I can barely handle the one life I lead, let alone trying to help, someone else's life. If people are listening to this and they think, man, what a great organization, and they would like to be able to help out, but they don't live nearby. They want to have something like this in their own community. How would you recommend that they do something like that?
Well, I mean, anyone is welcome to call me. And this is something that we stepped back and said, there are a lot of resources for our young people. What's missing? And that's how we developed All Leaders Must Serve. We wanted to make sure that young people understood that entitlement will not make you a leader, but becoming a servant mindset and really making a difference, that will make you a leader. So that's our premise. I'm open to share that with anyone, because I'm sure there are other programs out there that do something like this, but I only know of ours. So it starts with understanding your youth first.
Is it something that you think that someone could pick up and drop somewhere else? You guys are just around Sacramento, California. Is it someone that in, you know, Philadelphia could model after your program and would be applicable there?
I do. In fact, if you're in an area where young people are immigrants or their parents speak a different language, and or there's just poverty and there are not enough models in that community, it's a wonderful program to bring your professionals and your retired people who are just going to, I like to say it like this, love on them, because as you can tell, we do more than just teaching, and just be available. Those young people need to know that they are valued and they're seen, and they need to learn how to communicate what's in their heart, because they all do have value and their communities need what they have to offer.
I'm also wise enough to know that where you guys are a nonprofit, that nonprofits always love to receive funds and donations. How could someone do that if they've been inspired by your particular story, Jane?
Well, we have a website called allleadersmustserve.org, and there is a monthly giving that we are looking. We're very grassroots. We don't get government funding, and we're all volunteer at this point. But we are trying to build our grassroots funding so that we can actually have more services for our youth. We're very service-oriented, where 80% of our funds go to our youth. So there's a donate button. Please feel free to hit it and donate. We will appreciate every dollar and make sure that you get credit for that giving.
Well, thank you, Jane, and thank you for sharing your program, the details, and the impact that you're making on these teens' lives.
Thank you.
Jane's the founder of All Leaders Must Serve. Again, this is an organization dedicated to empowering underserved youths ages 15 to 25 to become the leaders of tomorrow. And to support their cause, to learn more about the organization, you can go to allleadersmustserve.org.
If you've not yet subscribed to the Lisa Show podcast, might I encourage you to do so?
Here's your invitation right now.
You can subscribe wherever you get podcasts available. And there's usually a search function wherein you might search the Lisa Show to subscribe. And the reason being, if you did not listen to yesterday's Lisa Show, you missed a rousing story about a water pick. Now, if... I don't want to be too self-promotional or whatever.
You're not being self-promotional. It has changed people's lives already.
So just to catch everybody up, I mentioned briefly something that I had been told throughout my entire life. Try the water pick.
Yeah, why don't you do this? We're all given lots of advice, right, that we reluctantly take years later and think, well, why didn't I do this earlier? For you, that journey was the journey to your new love, the water pick.
Yeah, the chargeable reservoir in hand water pick, mind
okay.
you.
But settle down.
But so here's what I think is so fascinating. Day in and day out here on the Lisa Show, we talk about informational and educational topics like change your life by your sleep patterns and what is the culture going to be like when, you know, when we get post-pandemic, we come on the other side of that. And I think all of those things are great.
Yeah.
But I would be lying if I didn't tell you that the most comments that I have received about the show in the last 6 months was about the water pick discussion that we had yesterday. I didn't know.
I know. Isn't
it funny?
I thought
I was alone in my water pick, but apparently not. So if you don't listen to every waking moment of this show, I want you to know you're missing out on rousing discussions about things like water picks. Be sure you subscribe to The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts.
What are the habits that are going to help any kid improve their mental health? That's coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
Each new phase of life brings new and unique challenges, and for both kids and their parents, Nothing seems more trying than the teen and tween years. The teenage era brings questions about one's identity, struggles to find good friends, and rebellion. And parents play an important role during this phase of their kids' lives. And we need to be reminded of that. Because I am a parent of many teenagers in my home right now.
Multiples.
And I feel that when I talk to other parents about their teenagers, we want to have more influence than it seems that we're having. But I think that that is a lot of perception, right?
Yeah, but all teenagers are the same, right, Lisa? Right. Like if you've had one teenager, it's the same as the next one, right?
Richie, no!
And they just are waiting for the information which you can impart to them to have better lives.
You look very confused. That's how I feel. I will tell you that my fifth is a teenager now. And
congratulations.
Well, thank you. It is difficult to navigate this for them and for me. It brings back feelings and emotions that I had as a teenager. And they're going through a unique experience. You want to be involved. You want to help. There are certain ways that I think are more effective than others. And we want to talk about those ways that are effective because we all want to help our tweens and teens overcome their toughest challenges. So we are inviting in on the conversation speaker, best-selling author, and psychotherapist Amy Moore. And she's the author of 13 Things Strong Kids Do. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about, teenagers, they're, you know, this is such a hard time, and we sort of leave it at that, I think this would be a great way to start off the conversation to talk about the biggest challenges that are facing teens in general. What are they to you?
So many teens obviously have felt like they've lost an entire year of their lives, and in some ways they have throughout the pandemic. They haven't been able to socialize with their friends. They've missed out on a lot of those rites of passage. They've missed out on sports, a lot of the things that are really important to the teen years. So, and it didn't necessarily eliminate the other problems teens face in terms of social media pressure or the pressure to make bad decisions when it comes to trying drugs or cigarettes or alcohol. So a lot of kids are struggling more than ever right now as we start to emerge from the pandemic, and they're thinking, well, now what? There's still so much uncertainty about their future.
And in that uncertainty, you know, Liz, like you were saying, just regular, plain old regular uncertainty for all of us. And I appreciate that you were looking for ways to strengthen our kids. And what do you mean by strong when you refer to these kids? What makes them strong?
So mental strength is really about the way you think, feel, and behave. And so often, as parents, we want to help kids, but we do it in a way that we do the work for them, and we don't teach them how to do it. So when you have a child who says something like, I am never going to be good at math, we're usually really quick to jump in and say, oh, no, honey, you do a good job, or you'll be fine, or that test you're worried about, you'll do a good job on it, rather than teaching them how to think for themselves. So we want kids to know that their brains lie to them and that they can challenge those negative thoughts sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to their emotions, sometimes we minimize how they feel. We say, oh, don't worry about that recital that you're concerned about. It's not a big deal. Or that friendship issue that you're upset about. Just stop worrying or stop being so upset. But then we're telling them their feelings are wrong.
Right.
We want to teach kids that it's okay to be anxious, it's okay to be sad, and that they have some control over how they feel. They can take steps to manage those really uncomfortable emotions. And then when it comes to their behavior, so often we just want to prop them up and we want them to do a good job, so we end up either eliminating the obstacles that stand in their way, or we push them or prod them along. We want kids to know that they can do tough things, they can persist at hard tasks, or that they can do things even when they don't feel like doing it. Nobody wants to clean their room, but it's okay to do it anyway, even if you're feeling kind of bored or tired. Or that when they are faced with a problem, so many teenagers just want to avoid it. Mm-hmm. We want to teach them how to solve problems. And then when it comes to the problems they can't solve, like a health issue of somebody in the family, you can't fix that, but you can address how you feel about that. So we want them to know that they can take some kind of positive action, no matter what kind of challenges they face.
So as you've sort of talked about some of these, things that kids can do, you've written the book 13 Things Strong Kids Do. Are each of those things what you've just spoken about some of those things, or are they particular skills that kids should be learning to be strong?
So the book is broken down into the things that we ultimately want them to achieve. Like, we want kids to know that they can empower themselves, they can fail and try again, they can persist. But under how do you do those things? So each chapter then contains strategies that will help them, I think, big, feel good, and act brave, which is the subtitle of the book. But I wanted to give real actionable exercises of how you, say, persist at hard tasks. Well, you change how you think. You get more comfortable with feeling uncomfortable, and you figure out how do you act brave even when you necessarily don't feel brave. And so my hope is that kids will read this book and come away with a real set of tools of, okay, when I feel this way, here are five things I could try. When I'm struggling with this specific problem, here are eight different exercises that could work. I'm going to pick my favorite one. And I want parents to then know, okay, this is what I can do. Because as parents, we don't want to see our kids be sad. We don't want to watch them fail. It's hard to do. But when we know, okay, we have tools, we have skills, we have strategies that we can apply in real life right now that will work, then parents feel empowered to say, all right, I can let you fail, or I can let you deal with this problem on your own. I'm going to guide you rather than protect you from the pain.
How did you go about finding out what it is that strong kids do?
Well, so my first book was called 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. And that book came about because I was a therapist, and I studied the people in my therapy office every single day and came to the conclusion that what separated people who go through tough times and stay stuck versus people that go through tough times and really grow from it, they learn from it, they thrive, was often not about what they did. It was more about what they didn't do. People who didn't have certain bad habits could face adversity, go through life's toughest challenges, and still reach their greatest potential. So when that book hit the shelves, though, the biggest question I kept getting from readers was, how do we teach this to kids? And that led to my second book, which was a parenting book. And since then, I've just had so many parents say, I wish I would have had this material when I was a kid. And I agree. I wish I would have known these things when I was 10 years old. So it's been a long time coming to write a kid's book, and I'm excited that it's here because I wanted to say, if kids grow up learning how to do these 13 things, they won't grow up to develop those unhealthy habits that ultimately drain so many of us adults of mental strength.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking with Amy Morin, author of the book 13 Things Strong Kids Do. We've sort of talked around about what these challenges that our kids face and what we as parents can do, and you sort of have spoken your journey as to how you got to write this book. I would be curious, why is this focus for our tweens and teens so vital now?
When I wrote the book at the beginning of the pandemic, I had no idea that here we'd be a year later still in this very similar situation. So I think right now more than ever, this book is definitely needed. And when we look at the stress that's caused by the pandemic, so often we talk about adults. We know that adults have faced financial problems. Adults have faced so many issues and having to make decisions about whether to see grandparents or to let kids go to school. But we don't really talk that much about the stress and the toll it's taken on children. But in almost every study, we found that 11 to 17-year-olds are much more likely to be depressed than any other age group right now. That this has taken a serious toll on kids, that they're struggling with anxiety. When we looked at what happened to kids in China, they came out of quarantine. A lot of them had symptoms of PTSD, depression, anxiety, even months later. So we know that even though hopefully this pandemic is winding down and things are going to start to reopen again, kids might not necessarily just bounce right back. They might struggle for a while. And my hope is that this book will give them some tools so that they can build mental strength. And to know that mental strength and mental health aren't the same thing. If you have depression, that doesn't mean that you're weak. Just like if you were going to the gym to build physical muscle, it doesn't mean you won't ever get high cholesterol, but it does keep you healthier, and it helps you to feel more empowered that you can face certain problems in your life.
You know, earlier you mentioned that parents, in their desire to help, our well-intentioned, right, desire to build up our kids, may be undermining their own grit and resiliency in saying, oh, everything's going to be okay, or minimizing things. So what is it that parents can do, really, to help support their kids as they overcome the challenges that they're facing right now?
Exactly. So we want to teach kids how to do a lot of those things for themselves, because that's a lifelong skill. So, for example, when your child comes to you and says, I'm never going to be able to pass math class, you don't want to say, oh, honey, you'll do just fine, because then you're doing it for them. Instead, you want to ask a question like, what would you say to your friend who said he could never pass math class? Mm. And your child might be like, oh, I give him advice. I tell him that he'll do just fine, or he can ask the teacher for help. Kids are really nice to their friends and really quick to give their friends advice. We want them to learn that they can talk to themselves in that same compassionate way. Or when you have a child who comes to you and says, I'm really nervous because I'm supposed to give a speech in front of the class, and I don't think I can do it. Instead of saying, like, oh, you'll be fine, or don't worry about it, we want to teach them, oh, okay, so you feel anxious. Just putting a label to how they feel takes a lot of the sting out of it. There's tons of research behind that, that when a kid can say, I'm anxious, they immediately feel a little less anxious. And we don't want to tell them not to feel anxious. We want to teach them, okay, so you're anxious about giving a speech. Well, what can you do even though you feel nervous? Maybe you practice. Maybe you have a little saying you say to yourself as you get up there. Maybe you just know, all right, my heart's going to beat fast and my palms are sweaty, but it's not the end of the world. And when we give kids those sorts of messages, they grow up knowing, okay, even when mom or dad aren't right there with me, I can still face these tough challenges in life.
I think that that draw, and I don't want to underestimate that, just to really help and to build up our kids, is so strong that we may plan on asking them, you know, questions that they can answer themselves. But in a real situation, I mean, I could just, if my kid came to me and said, I'm feeling really anxious about this presentation, I'd say, okay, well, let's practice. What can
Here's
I do to help?
You need to do, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, these kinds of things have helped me, you know, and offering help and advice and in a well-meaning. It's hard to kind of slow down and have the wherewithal to ask them those questions to try to get it out of them, especially when some teenagers may come back with a, I don't know, or I'd say don't do it, yeah. Or, you know, kind of ask or answer in a hesitant way. What advice do you have to push through those moments to really create the good habits that we want our kids to establish for themselves?
And those are all good points. One of my hopes is by having this book for kids that if you have older kids that they can read it on their own, mm-hmm. and then parents can read it too. And then you have the same language. So when you say, is that a blue thought or a true thought? Your child knows what that means. Or you can come up with, say, 5 exercises together, and then you let your child pick which one they want to try. And that empowers them to say, okay, I can do this on my own. But yet, we're still giving them the guidance that they need. Obviously, no 10-year-old's going to read a self-help book and change their lives based on that. Mm-hmm. But if we have the same information and we can support them, we can go a long way toward helping them. And when you have a kid who says, well, nothing's going to work, when you can create a list of 5 different strategies and you say, well, you can pick which one, you're still empowering them so that they feel like they have a choice. Or you could do A or B. Which one do you want to do? Then they're like, all right. I at least have some say in this. And that's what really helps kids later in life, is for them to know there are choices, there are options, and they can take some kind of action in life no matter what kind of problem they're facing.
As we get to know you a little bit better, I would be curious if you could take your 13 things and go to the younger Amy. What would be the thing that you would stress to your younger self to be stronger in?
I would say to take more calculated risks. So as a kid, I didn't really calculate risk. I grew up in the country where we drove 4-wheelers and never wore helmets and those sorts of things. None of that was scary. But the idea of getting up in front of the class, this is why I always use this, I think, as an example, because for me that was terrifying. If it was the day that we had to give a speech in front of the class, I would, you know, fake sick. I'd do everything I could to get out of it, because that seemed like the most terrifying thing in the world. So if I could talk to my younger self, I would talk about the fact that there's a much greater risk in riding that 4-wheeler without a helmet at top speed going down a hill than there is in talking in front of 12 of your peers who you've been with since kindergarten, that those things are okay, and that anxiety isn't the end of the world. We all have faulty anxiety alarms that go off at the wrong time. And I think just having that information would have helped me so much as a kid.
I like that perspective,
yeah.
Right? You think
because we can all relate
you
to
think,
it.
You think nothing of the four wheelers and then the class of 12. Amy Morin, best-selling author and psychotherapist. You can find her new book, 13 Things Strong Kids Do, Think Big, Feel Good, Act Brave, wherever books are sold. We encourage you always to go to that local bookstore in your neighborhood. Amy, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I love having the discussion of parents and kids having the same language to be able to discuss challenges that they're both facing and that and letting down your guard and being vulnerable and saying, I used to worry about this and I wish that I could tell my younger self that. Those kinds of discussions, I think, can be really effective for tweens and teenagers when you're just trying to connect and express that you're trying to help and not trying to boss them.
Well, you hit on the thing that was the hardest for me with my son when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
Is he would come with something and I'd be like, well, you know what you need to do.
I know.
Well, you know what you got to do. And to just be able to be curious in the moment and ask questions and, you know, sort of let them have the opportunity to decide to sort of gather their mind around the situation and how they might be able to find the solution. Nah, I was like, well, then what we do? And then
I know,
the second
because
step,
you want to plan because you want to be helpful. And we can never underestimate the effectiveness of asking good questions and listening, which is hard because I have to close my mouth.
Really?
And not give advice. And then later, I just say to my sister, I have lots of good ideas. Would you like to hear some of the good ideas that my kids didn't want to hear? And she's like, sure.
Here are some situations they're going through, and here's what I wanted to say.
Keeping the communication lines open. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143.
Find and subscribe to the Lisa Show podcast wherever you get podcasts. Find the subscribe button and click it. That's how you don't miss a single moment of the show.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to find out what we can each do to fight the tide of anti-Asian hate.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.